I tried the kitchen door. It was locked. I looked in the window, saw nothing. I moved around the rear perimeter, came to the next window, and saw nothing. Moved to the next window, and saw Frasconi lying on his back. He was in the middle of the living room floor. There was a sofa and two armchairs, all covered in durable, mud-colored fabric. The floor was done in wall-to-wall carpet, and it matched the olive of his uniform. He had been shot once through the forehead, 9mm, fatal. Even through the window, I could see the single, crusted hole and the dull ivory color of his skull under his skin. There was a lake of blood under his head. It had soaked into the carpet and was already drying and turning dark. I didn't want to go in on the first floor. If Quinn was still in there, he would be waiting upstairs where he had the tactical advantage. So I dragged the patio table over to the back of the garage and used it to climb onto the roof. Used the roof to get me next to an upstairs window. Used my elbow to get me through the glass. Then I went feet first into a guest bedroom. It smelled musty and unused. I walked through it and came out in an upstairs hallway, stood still and listened. Heard nothing. The house sounded completely empty. There was a deadness, a total absence of sound. No human vibrations. But I could smell blood. I came out in an upstairs hallway, stood still and listened. Heard nothing. The house sounded completely empty. There was a deadness, a total absence of sound. No human vibrations. But I could smell blood. I crossed the upstairs hallway and found Dominique Cole in the master bedroom. She was on her back on the bed. She was completely naked. Her clothes had been torn off. She had been hit in the face enough times to make her groggy, and then she had been butchered. Her breasts had been removed with a large knife. I could see the knife. It had been thrust upward through the soft flesh under her chin and through the roof of her mouth and into her brain. By that point in my life, I had seen a lot of things. I had once woken up after a terrorist attack with part of another man's jawbone buried in my gut. I had had to wipe his flesh out of my eyes before I could see well enough to crawl away. I had crawled 20 yards through severed legs and arms and butted my knees against severed heads with my hands pressed hard into my abdomen to stop my own intestines falling out. I had seen homicides and accidents and men machine-gunned in feuds and people reduced to pink paste in explosions and blackened, twisted lumps in fires. But I had never seen anything as bad as Dominique Cole's butchered body. I threw up on the floor, and then, for the first time in more than 20 years, I cried.
"So what now?" Villanueva said 10 years later.
"I'm going in alone," I said.
"I'm coming in with you."
"Don't argue," I said. "Just get me a little closer and drive real slow." It was a gray car on a gray day, and slow-moving objects are less perceptible than fast-moving objects. He took his foot off the brake and touched the gas and got it rolling at about 10 miles an hour. I checked the Beretta and its spare magazines. 45 rounds, less 2, fired into Duke's ceiling. I checked the persuaders. 14 rounds, less 1, fired through Holly's gut. Total of 56 rounds. Against less than 18 people. I didn't know who was on the guest list, but Emily Smith and Harley himself were going to be no-shows for sure.
"Stupid to do it alone," Villanueva said.
"Stupid to do it together. The approach is going to be suicidal." He didn't answer. "Better that you guys stand by out here." He made no reply to that. He wanted my back, and he wanted Teresa. But he was smart enough to see that walking toward a fortified and isolated house in the last of the daylight was going to be no kind of fun. He just kept the car rolling slowly. Then he took his foot off the gas and put the transmission in neutral and let it coast to a stop. He didn't want to risk the flare of brake lights in the mist. We were maybe a quarter mile short of the house. "You guys wait here," I said, "for the duration."
Villanueva looked away. Give me 1 hour. I waited until they both nodded. Then call ATF. After 1 hour, if I'm not back.
Maybe we should do that now,
Duffy said. No. I want that hour first.
ATF will get Quinn, she said. It's not like they're going to let him walk.
I thought back to what I had seen and just shook my head. I broke every regulation and ignored every procedure in the book. I walked away from a crime scene and failed to report it. I obstructed justice left and right. I left Cole in the bedroom and Frasconi in the living room, left their car on the driveway, just drove myself back to the office and took a silenced Ruger Standard 22 from the company armory and went to find Cole's boxed-up files. My gut told me Quinn would make one stop before he headed for the Bahamas. He would have an emergency stash somewhere. Maybe phony ID, maybe a wad of cash, maybe a packed bag, maybe all three. He wouldn't hide the stash on post, nor in his rented house. He was too professional for that, too cautious. He would want it safe and far away. I was gambling it would be in the place he had inherited in Northern California. From his parents, the railroad worker and the stay-at-home mom. So I needed that address. Cole's handwriting was neat. The two cartons were filled with her notes. They were comprehensive. They were meticulous. They broke my heart. I found the California address in an 8-page bio she had prepared. It was a 5-digit house number on a road that came under the Eureka post office. Probably a lonely place far out of town. I went to my company clerk's desk and signed a stack of travel warrants for myself, put my service Beretta and the silenced Ruger in a canvas bag, and drove to the airport. They gave me papers to sign before they let me carry loaded firearms inside the cabin. I wasn't about to check them. I figured there was a good chance Quinn might take the same flight. I figured if I saw him at the gate or on the plane, I would waste him right there and then. But I didn't see him. I got on a plane for Sacramento and walked the aisle after takeoff and scanned every face, and he wasn't there. So I sat tight for the duration of the flight, just stared into space. The stewardesses stayed well away from me. I rented a car at the Sacramento airport, drove it north on I-5, and then northwest on Route 299. It was a designated scenic road. It wound through the mountains. I looked at nothing except the yellow line ahead of me. I had picked up 3 hours because of flying across 3 time zones, but even so, it was gathering dark when I hit the Eureka limit. I found Quinn's Road. It was a meandering strip that ran north-south, high in the hills above US 101. The highway was laid out far below me. I could see headlights streaming north, taillights heading south. I guessed there was a rail line down there somewhere. Maybe a station or a depot nearby. Convenient for Quinn's old man back when he was working.